and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And sitting on my left is my friend, Al Val.
How's it going, man?
Well, Al put something in my head yesterday that I just can't get past, and two words, Count Dante.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. Like, I didn't even think about his name, but when I made that pose, you knew exactly what I was doing. You knew exactly what I was doing, even though I didn't know what I was doing. I was just making some fake karate pose.
There was four of us. Dallas, who you may remember, used to be on this show.
Yeah.
And then still is. Just hasn't been in a while.
In spirit, he's here.
And our friend Dez. We're going to Wilson's Book World in St. Pete to get some dollar comic books. We ended up somehow, the conversation went to martial arts. Al struck that pose, and I started laughing and said, Count Dante. If you didn't read comic books in the 1970s, you may not know who he was, but there was all these ads and all the Marvel and possibly DC comics. There was a guy with a Fu Manchu mustache, an afro, and he was in a kung fu pose, and he had the touch of death, I think is what you could learn.
Yeah.
The touch of death if you sent $5 for a booklet.
Yep.
I always thought he was a made-up, but I just thought he was like the Quaker Oats man, you know, Aunt Jemima, you know.
He was a real dude.
Yeah.
He was a real man. He was a kind of controversial guy, I guess, because I guess he was, they said something about, like, he was an early martial arts guy bringing it here or whatever to the U.S. He had tournaments and stuff like that.
Yeah, I wonder if he's one of the Marines that was in Japan.
Yes, he was, yeah. I think.
A lot of martial arts came to the United States because the occupation forces after World War II in Japan. And, you know, the Marines stayed. The problem was that Japan was blown out. A lot of people couldn't work. And if you were a martial arts instructor, as long as you had an open space or somewhere, you could train. And the Marines went and paid. And so a lot of the people that came back over here, like Ed Parker, you know, that started American Kempo, that's where a lot of the martial arts started coming to the United States.
Yeah, he was in the Marine Reserves and later the Army, where he learned hand-to-hand combat and jiu-jitsu techniques. He was trained under various martial arts masters during the infancy of Western interest in Asian martial arts during the 50s. Most notably of the early masters he trained under was Sensei Robert Trias. Is that name familiar to you at all?
No, that doesn't mean anything. It could be somebody. I don't know everybody.
Okay. I was just checking to see if he was like one of the more famous people or anything like that. Yeah, his style was called Dim Mac.
Yeah, Dim Mac.
And the Dim Mac. And the book was like, this book, the deadliest, I can't even read it now because it's so, the ad's so little, but the deadliest fighting styles or whatever it's called, that you can get a copy of that like on Amazon. I swear to God, they're selling it. Yeah, and I guess his deal was that he knew he was going to teach you, like, I don't know how many moves you can make and you can disarm somebody or whatever. But at any rate, it's a famous advertisement.
Yeah, it ran in everything, and as soon as Al did the pose, I immediately recognized it, and it was a really cool ad.
Yeah, and look, in this one from the 60s, he's got shorter hair, but by the early 70s, he had a big fro.
Yeah, I thought he was a black man, because it was a high-contrast photo, and I guess
I could see that with a fro.
Yeah, I thought he was a black man. I come to find out he was not.
Yeah, he ended up changing his name. I think he had I think his name was Keehan, Jack Keehan. He ended and changed his name to like Count
Dante,
Count something Raphael Dante or something like that. It just set off, this ad just set off like the basic idea that I don't even know if we really talked in depth about all these all these strange ads and comic books, but I guess we can go through some of them and like. I mean, the most obvious one is Sea Monkeys.
Well, but there was some other martial arts one. There was
yeah,
there
was.
It's learned
jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, and had the target. You could get a life-size poster, I think, and it was an illustration of a man with a mask holding a gun or knife at you. It looked like a real criminal, and it had all the vital points listed, I guess, that you would attack. Yeah, and there's the karate, judo, jiu-jitsu.
With the guy, with like the guy and the girl there. You know, you'll have complete self-defense mastery in 24 hours. Can you guarantee that, Don, at your school? No.
No, but I wanted, you know, I'm making fun of it. I wanted every one of these books when I was a kid.
I bet.
Well, you know, you think about when you're growing up, you don't have any back history. You don't really, you're just a kid. And I wasn't one of the upper echelon kids that, you know, all the schools had. I was just a skinny guy that, you know, liked to draw. I couldn't do too much of anything. And sometimes school can be really rough.
Oh, God, yeah. Hell yeah. The jerky kids.
You're always looking for some secret thing. And, man, maybe this will help me. I never sent off for it. I don't know anybody that did. But I did want to. And I'd look at these like, hey, I wonder if this could help. Maybe.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I'm a little bit older than you. But, I mean, we read the books at the same time. I never got that idea to go and, you know, join like a dojo or learn anything like that. I just figured, hey, you know, if somebody comes at me, I'll try my best or I'll run or something.
Yeah, that's probably it. There was a karate school by one of the houses we lived at. My dad did take me. I wanted to
train. Oh, yeah? Okay.
But I saw them stretching and stuff, and they didn't seem to know what they were doing. My dad wasn't too thrilled because they had a Buddha statue in the lobby, and he just thought idolatry, so that was kind of the end of that. But one kid I went to school with did start going there, and I guess his parents were having to buy pads and stuff for him as he got higher. And I was saying, wow, that's okay. And then he got in a fight with some kid at school and just got whipped all over the place, and that kid didn't know how to fight either. So,
really? Wow.
So it happens. I mean, I was always kind of skeptical of martial arts. And then I ended up meeting the guy that was in a Taekwondo school. He was always trying to get me to come in. He was actually really good. So, yeah, but I never sent off for a comic book ad.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Dante one was a little more, looked more formable. This was like kind of like some not too greatly drawn.
Yeah, well, it's still a pretty neat ad.
It's a neat ad, yeah.
Came later.
This one was even in the Archie books. It was one of those Archie books that I got yesterday. I had that one, and so I guess they were like, you know, trying to get all the kids, including the Archie kids, the Marvel kids, the DC kids, whoever.
Well, yeah, that one, that book, the Karate Jiu-Jitsu one, that came out in the later 70s. Count Dante was in, I think, the mid-70s.
He died
early.
In 75. So
oh, it was
from like around 68 till like early 70s. What I was reading about him was he was actually trying to get together, unite martial arts with street fighting, because I guess maybe he was thinking that, like, okay, great, martial arts really wonderful and that, but in a street fight, like you said, you might not win or whatever. So
well, and that's a good idea too, because what happened was the original guys that started some of these styles, they always talk about how karate and judo were always bitter enemies. Kind of find out the two guys that created those styles were pretty good friends, and they'd meet each other and trade techniques.
Oh, okay.
But when those men went on, you know, their schools, their other students, they were the ones that kept us separate, which it kind of happens. You know, you kind of need it, but it starts getting stoic, and you start forgetting what you're doing, and it just starts to be more of an art instead of an actual working thing. And you have to get out in the field and plow, you know, to do it. You can't just stand on the side and watch it. So what he did, you know, that was a good thing. He may have been quite well. We have a guy at our school that he rents the school after our class once a week. And he was all excited. He likes comic books and stuff. And he was telling me, you remember that Count Dante? He was talking to one of his students.
A guy at work said that?
No, a guy at the school.
At the school, okay.
And he was kind of excited because he met one of Count Dante's students, I guess, somewhere in Illinois. And he was trying to bring him down for a seminar.
Oh.
And I thought that guy was made up, like Captain Crunch or Betty Crocker or
something.
Right. You know, he's a real guy. No disrespect, I was having trouble believing it. I says, are you sure? You know, and he you know, kept telling me about it, so I started looking it up. That was funny you brought this up, you know, yesterday. But he was a real martial artist. I'm guessing that I see some martial artists, you start building this mystique around you. You're trying to, it's a marketing thing.
Marketing.
And for some people, it works quite well, and they get real successful. And other people, you just think, oh, they're full of it, and you kind of laugh at them. But I guess because I just always saw him in the comic ad, I just never believed it was a real person, you know. So,
Count Dante. Well, here's a weird one, and this one is interesting to me because it comes from the town that I used to live in, Hialeah. Pet baby raccoons has always been and still is America's favorite pet. Really easy to care for. $29.95 with cage. Send money order. I mean, would you really order a raccoon?
What year was this?
This looks like it's from the 60s.
That's a lot of money.
$30 for a raccoon. You can get them like, you know, like in the trash dumpsters around here. But you take a chance, you're going to get rabies.
The problem with raccoons is they're an extremely intelligent animal.
Are they really?
Oh, yeah. And they have little itty-bitty hands that can get through anything. My uncle had one he caught and kept in Texas. I was 4 or 5 years old. And I'll tell you, that raccoon was nothing but trouble all the time. They had him hanging on a pine tree. He had a little hutch. It was wood, you know, but he had a screen front, screen back with a latch. And it was hanging off of a limb. And, and the raccoon could get the little raccoon hands through that screen, undo the latch, get out, and he'd go up the pine tree.
Really?
And my dad and his two brothers would be standing there watching it. Nothing they could do, and the raccoon would be going up, looking down at him, going, brr, brr. I thought, why do you keep him as a pet? He's nothing but trouble. And they kept, every time I'd hear my Uncle Gary tell me and my cousin, you boys stay away from that coon. And one time he got into the house, nearly got boiled in Grandma's cooking.
Oh,
and
man.
I'm thinking, why, you know, raccoons are really neat characters, but, you know, God gave it a bandit mask for a reason. don't take a raccoon as a pet.
Do they have thumbs?
I don't think
we said
so.
They could escape from the cage. I'm thinking that maybe they were like, they had some kind of...
I guess I never really looked. I never got close. I listened to my uncle and didn't get close to that coon. So, but they're all over here in Florida, and I do like them. I just wouldn't want one as a pet.
And, of course, here's another one from Miami Beach. You can get a darling pet monkey from AT for $18.95. I mean, can you imagine squirrel monkeys? It's like, huh?
Yeah, 1968. That was a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. The $20 in 1968 is like, I don't know, a couple hundred now or something, or maybe at least 100.
No, I wouldn't want a pet monkey either.
I read somebody online said they had their uncle ordered one, and it lived for like about 10, 15 years or something like that. But that's just weird that people were selling everything, all this stuff like live pet seahorses from same place, you know, Florida Seahorse Company, Miami Beach. It's like, the kind of stuff that was in there was just like, I don't know. It's just very strange. Here's a good one here. We're just going through this blog, See-Through Walls, not from Uncle Spipe.
Oh, yeah. I've never seen one of those.
I read somebody said, you know what? That's funny that I'm just looking at it. My friend wanted to get one of these so I could check out his sister.
Well, you know the X-ray specs.
Everybody
knows X-ray specs and the ads. I never saw a real one, and I was always so fascinated. My best friend said, "Yeah, we can use that and watch my sister." And I said, "Would that really work?" And
that's just all sorts of wrong.
Well, we were kids, and it was basically just.
But it's like, but this they even like use the they even use a. Robert Vaughn and David McCallum on here, so I guess they made
Well, they have the logo too, man.
They have the logo. Like, when you were a kid, did you have like all the Man from Uncle briefcases and?
No, I saw the show and they had the girl from Uncle, which was
Stephanie Powers.
Yeah, Stephanie Powers.
Oh man, she was good looking.
And I used to watch those when I was little, but no, I remember. Well, no, I did. I had like a. Because the toys were always the James Bond stuff.
Yeah,
they were always the
Bond,
gun that could turn in. It was a cigarette lighter that could turn into a gun. I think it had a camera that turned into a gun.
Yeah.
And they used to have a toy. It wasn't Man from Uncle. It was just a generic toy called Six Finger. It looked like a human finger that was a little gun.
Oh, I saw a commercial for it on YouTube for Six Finger.
I had one. I was 5, and I thought it was the greatest thing in the whole planet. Shot little plastic darts.
Oh, God. Too funny. Okay, well, here's the classic one. Hey, skinny, all right, your ribs are showing. We're like the man. Usually the one you saw was the beach. Oh, this is the beach thing.
That's
yeah.
the famous one. Yeah,
the famous one. And I, again, I never order any of this stuff, but some guy posted that he ordered it, and all they sent you was like some rubber band so you can do like dynamic tension.
Well, they
or
had
whatever
pictures of it in some of these. That's Joe Weider, right?
Charles Atlas.
Oh, Charles Atlas. So, yeah, Charles Atlas. And there's a funny connection to bodybuilding in the comic books, besides the fact that all the superheroes are muscle bound.
Yeah, yeah.
But the United States got a real fitness thing in the 30s. And gyms were opening up, schools were opening up gyms. It basically was just an open room with, you know, weights and equipment, you know, medicine ball, basketball, you know, whatever you could. But everybody was just fascinated with getting physically fit. And you had all the girly mags, and you also had weightlifting mags.
Yep.
Bodybuilding fitness magazines was crazy. And a lot of the guys like Martin Goodman was jumping in on these things. And then that's where the comic book started coming out of. And, you know, it was basically, they were all bedfellows. And then that's why Joe Weider, Charles Atlas, those guys continued, possibly still continue to advertise in comic books.
Yeah, well, I knew a guy that had one of those, a kid that had one of those Charles Atlas books. And it was like, if I remember correctly, a lot of it was just pushing against walls and building, you know, like,
right,
stuff like that. It wasn't like weights. It was almost like without weights, just make contact against the wall and press against it and whatever that way. And it's like, okay, well, maybe it works. I don't know, you know.
I was always told the lighter weights give you more bulk.
They work with the lighter weights too?
That's what I'm told. You can't just work out a little bit. You got to work out a lot. But if you work for strength, you're using heavier weights. I've been around other martial arts masters that always kind of made fun of that. One guy was a pressure point guy, and when he would teach, he would hang up all these pictures for the weightlifting magazines, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, these guys. Well, your nerve endings is the pressure points, and those muscles end, everywhere they end is the nerve ending. So it's basically... he would hang up these pictures, and then he could point to all the nerve endings so you could learn them. You know, normal human beings, you don't see it. But if you have all that definition, and, you know, the guy would always make fun of it, says, why would you want to look like this? Because it's basically painting the target all over the pressure points for you. But he would always bag on guys that were really big and, you know, fit like that. Because he said they worked out with lighter weights, whereas people like me was okay because there's no definition.
Oh, see, I thought it was the other way around. I thought the heavier the weight you are, I thought that the more reps you did with lighter weight, it made you more defined. With the heavier weight that you did, it gave you more bulk, so you had to combine that. But maybe it's the opposite.
I think there is something to it, because I see a lot of football, you know, professional football players, American style, and some of those guys are all buff like that.
Yeah.
But I think if you're going to get the balloony muscles that you go on stage with and pose and win, you know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Roland Dantes did, I think you have to be, I think it has to be some of the, I mean, when I say that, those guys are strong. I mean, it is a lot of work.
Well, you know, Schwarzenegger was also like chemically altered too.
Yeah, well.
And a lot of that was going on back then. Even in the 80s, it was still kind of, you know, it's like, oh, well, I'm not taking steroids. I'm just combining this and this, which combined is the same thing as a steroid or whatever. Here's one that I never ordered from, but I don't know if you did. You ever have, when you were a kid, did you have like a little turtle and like
Yeah, I did, but I got mine at TGMY.
That's right. I bought the, for some reason, back in the 60s, maybe even the 70s, at like food markets. They had like a little, and they'd have like displays with fish and turtles, and that's what I did too. I got like a turtle out of it. It didn't last long.
Yeah, my best friend that lived next door, he had one too. All the kids had one, and I loved it, and it eventually died. And I remember one time my friend, we were getting in the car, and Mom said, close the door. So I closed the door, and I didn't realize his hand. I got his finger in the door.
Aww.
And it was an accident. I did what I was told. But the whole time we were driving, you know, I'm in the back seat, he's just crying and screaming, and he just kept saying, I'm glad your turtle died.
Well, here's the funny thing about the turtle. I had a turtle, and he died. So I actually had me and my friends together, and we gave him a burial.
Yeah, yeah.
I went back a couple of days later just to see if, like, you know, if anybody had messed with it. Yeah, turtle didn't die. He was still alive.
Oh, man.
He split. He played possum. It was a turtle playing possum. He pretended like he was dead because he was like, he wouldn't come out of the shell, and I thought he might have been dead. He He was just alive. He was just like, screw you, I'm not coming out of here. I want out. So he might be some big old giant turtle somewhere in South Florida now, for all I know.
You know, they stopped. They made them illegal to sell.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I think it was, I had mine in the 60s, but I think when the 70s, like 71, it rolled around and they made it illegal to sell. And it's because of salmonella. Kids were getting salmonella poisoning. And then I guess sometime in the 80s they started bringing them back. But they said the problem was kids would handle the turtles and then wash their hands
and get sick.
So
sure.
They kept stressing all the time, wash your hands, wash your hands. So.
Yeah, again, a friend of mine had a turtle, and he just, instead of keeping it like in the whatever, in his little turtle thing inside the house, he just let it go in his backyard. And like years later, I saw this big turtle there, not humongous, but like, you know, as big as like a big pancake or whatever, and he goes, oh yeah, that was my baby turtle. We just left them out in the backyard and they just kept eating the grass and he just grew that much. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So I guess if you would have just left them running around in your backyard and no cats or creatures got them, they would be like big old turtles.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is kind of cool, actually. I never even thought about that. Just had them in the house, put them in a little whatever, like a little turtle, you know, a little island looking thing. And oh, here's one. The old, like, draw this kid. If you can draw this character, send away for the art correspondence course. I've seen some of the art correspondence course books. I saw them at a used bookstore or whatever. I don't know how helpful they were, but I guess if you could do that already, I don't know how much they could help you, you know?
Huh.
I mean, it is a profile, so it's not like, it can't be that difficult, but.
Yeah, I used to like to draw the animals and have different animals, the same thing as a profile. And I says, draw me, and send it in, and they'll tell you if you need help. I used to like to draw the animals, but I never sent in for
I think they would send a guy to your house. It's almost like another thing that we don't have anymore, the encyclopedia salesman that comes to your house or whatever. They just send somebody to your house and like go, hey, look, you know, you got talent, kid. You know, here's some. I guess it would be helpful.
It was a more open world then.
It is too. Oh, here's one that was really bizarre. This isn't the one, but I saw one the other day of the stamps, send away for stamps. I saw one the other day that, I don't know if I was talking to you now, maybe I was, I think it was from the 50s or 60s, and it was like, oh, send away for stamps, and if you do, you get eight free Hitler stamps, and I'm like, really? Really? Okay, I guess, there he is, look, a Hitler stamp right there, yeah. Stamps from all over the world, it's like, wow, in the 60s they still had Hitler stamps, huh? Okay.
Well, he, like I said, he was...
Free stamps all over the world with Hitler, yeah. Had all of these deals. When I was a kid, I did one of these and got an envelope full of stamps. Were they worth anything? Probably not, but it was cool to see stamps from all over the world. Wonder what the Adolf Hitler stamp is worth these days. I never was a stamp collector, but I knew people that were. And I guess back in the 70s, it was probably, there were stores. I remember in Miami, there was a stamp store where you bought stuff, and it had a name to it, and it was a fancy name, and I can't remember what it was. But my friend actually, I think when his dad passed away, he had a stamp book, and he sold it, and he got some money out of it, or whatever. But yeah, that was another one of the classic ones, or whatever. Oh, here you go, The Haunting Record. There's another one.
I did know people that had that.
Oh, you did know people that had that. Okay.
And they bring it to school on Halloween. It was just all sound effects.
Yeah, it was like that Disney one that I remember.
Like the Disney one.
The scary sounds of the haunted house or whatever.
And when I used to trick-or-treat, sometimes some houses would have that playing, which was always exciting.
This one I never saw before, but this is pretty amazing.
I don't think that was, but that couldn't have been a comic book.
Looks like it. It says life-size inflatable doll classic comic book ad for $9.95.
I must have been reading the wrong comics, too. That's just...
Yeah, I don't know. And it comes with a blonde wig or a brunette wig.
$9.95.
That's pretty scary,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah, that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean... I mean, she probably does not look like this. I've never seen that one.
That pictures of real women, which, you know...
That one I've never seen before. And of course the one I was talking about before, the
seahorse ring.
The seahorses, yeah. I guess what you said, they were brine shrimp?
No, that was the sea monkeys.
Oh, the sea monkeys. Seahorses were real seahorses then.
Yeah, It looks like that. If you grow up in Texas and Oklahoma, a seahorse is an extremely
common.
It's like a unicorn or a dragon. I mean, it's just something you don't see, and except in Aquaman comics, you know, monster-sized monsters.
Yeah, this is they're probably like cardboard paste-ups or whatever.
Well, I didn't send off for that, but the Moon Man ad. You remember that?
You sent off for the Moon Man?
I did send off for that.
Was it a cardboard cutout?
It was. It came in a manila envelope. Basically, what the thing was, it had this fantastic picture of this moon monster that just looked horrendous. And it cost a dollar. The thing was, I think, 6 feet tall. And it kept saying, life-size Moon Man poster, or Moon Monster poster. It also came with three masks of the Wolfman, the Mummy, and Frankenstein, I think. And it also came with, I think, two posters and something from Boris Karloff. Yeah. Giant life-size moon monster. Over 6 feet
tall.
Yeah,
there you go. Three monster masks.
Yeah, extra bonus. It's all free when, you know, you join the Monster Fan Club. It has something from Boris Karloff in it.
Yeah, it says 12x5 glossy photos of your favorite monsters. That's not bad. How much were they getting for this?
It was a dollar. At the time I ordered, it was a dollar. And all of his kids, I mean, the moon monster just looks fabulous. And but you're thinking life size. You're thinking it's like some type of giant statue or something. And so I sent off for it, and it came in a manila envelope.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was cardstock. It was paper. But the Moon Man was basically two folded giant posters you put together. One was the top, and one was the bottom.
Okay, yeah, makes sense.
And the masks were, again, three sheets of paper, you know, with they were basically grayscale photos or artwork photos of the Mummy, I think the Wolfman.
Yeah, it looks like a Frankenstein and the creature or the Wolfman.
But, you know, had a white section for the eyes, you know, and
yeah.
A thing for a rubber band, but you popped it out. They had, what was it? The two posters was basically they were just stills from monster movies.
That's neat.
And it was neat. It actually wasn't bad, but at the time, you know, a dollar was a lot of money. And I got all these papers that also had a picture of Boris Karloff with a little letter, like for the Monster Fan Club, talking about it.
Yeah, that's what it says here, yeah.
So it was several sheets of paper. I remember I got it, and my friend was with me, and when I pulled it all out, he goes, "Well, you got rooked." And it was one of those things where it wasn't as fabulous as you thought, but I didn't think it was that bad.
No, it doesn't sound that bad at all.
And I had the monster hanging in my room, but it always kind of freaked me out. My dad made me take it down. I know it's freaking my little brother out. A friend of mine in the back of his garage had his dad built a really nice clubhouse. You know, had a cot and everything. So he hung it all up in there. And I spent the night. We were supposed to stay the night in that clubhouse. And we didn't last. And finally, my dad was laughing about it, saying, I knew you boys wouldn't have stayed in there with those monster pictures. I remember I was looking at my friend, because we kept hearing these thumps. You know, we were like nine. And I looked up, are you scared? Yeah, he shook his head. Can we go in the house?
Oh, my God. Oh, that's too funny. Well, at least we had one of them, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, the Sea Monkeys is always the ad that always got me, because you wanted to order it. You know, it just looked neat, the drawing. I'm told it was by Russ Heath.
Yeah, and so was the Roman soldiers.
Yeah, the Roman soldiers. You order plastic Roman soldiers. Wow. I just figured it'd be like army men. But it wasn't. It was, I guess they were flat. They were plastic, but they were little flat silhouettes. Of
they weren't
characters.
Like the army men?
Yeah, I've seen it on the internet. I'll try to link some.
Oh, wow, but what a scam that was.
But the Sea Monkeys, they were supposed to be live, and they were brine shrimp. And they were so small, you couldn't even see them.
Oh, my God. Hey, let's take a break, man. You want to play
some
music?
Yeah, this is from the Sunshine Drenchy record sampler, and this is Geneva Wallet.
Walls like I've
Geneva Wallet, which you can get off the Sunshine Drinchy record sampler, and I'll have a link on the blog.
From our friend Steve Robinson.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd say friend.
From our co-worker.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, hopefully you'll have that new CD out so we can play some of it.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Well, just to finish off with the ads, I did order one thing one time from Captain Company. That was one of the more famous ones because that was in the back of the Warren magazines.
You know, the Warren magazines, that was one of my favorite things when I got Monsters, Famous Monsters,
Monsters
of Filmland.
Yeah.
Was I loved all the stuff in the back. They must have had a third of the magazine was ads.
Oh, yeah.
And I never ordered any from it, but it was a thrill. They had that Jack Davis
poster
Frankenstein. Yeah, which with the fur vest, which is awesome. They always had those 35mm films, the old Captain Marvel series and stuff, which just to me just seemed like another world that you couldn't touch. And they'd have magazines, the Spirit. I used to see the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd show the Pagel, This Isn't for Little Boys. And
yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
I was always kind of amazed at it. So, yeah, the Warren magazines, I never ordered anything out of them, but it's what they called wish books. You could look and wish that, you could get them.
Well, I did once, and God, it took like 3 months to get it. I ordered like an issue of Creepy.
Oh, really?
That I was missing, yeah, back in like the early 70s, late 60s. And, I sent in like 65 cents, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure I ordered it at the beginning of the summer. I didn't get it till I was getting ready to go back to school. It took a long time for it to get to you. I don't know if it was that busy or I'm pretty sure. It was like Flo Steinberg was running, a lot of the company.
Oh, yeah.
She was the one doing the mailing or doing a lot of the legwork on it or whatever. So, but it took a long time to get to you. But I did finally get it, and, it was nice.
That's one thing that used to drive me insane was Marvel Comics. I started finding some older ones when I was in, it's just when the 70s were rolling around. And I got so interested in the plastic figures they had of Iron Man, Spider-Man, and somebody said, that's gone. That was Marvel Mania. What? You can't get those anymore? No, it's Marvel Mania. It's Foom now.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess those figures are by Ideal. I've never seen them in person, but to this day, I'd still love to get one of those Iron Man plastic figures.
Oh, God. Yeah, I forgot about those. I'm surprised they haven't done retro ones.
Yeah, I was thinking of that, too. And also, remember the medallions that Foom had? They had one of Conan, one of Spider-Man.
Maybe they're on Amazon or eBay. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's one thing. Going on eBay and looking for the Moon Man and all those things, I'm sure there's got to be out there.
Well, there's a link to the Moon Man where it has a picture of all the stuff on it.
There is? We got to put it on there because I want to see it.
It was, like I said, I had it for a long time, but it was all gray. It was all grayscale printing,
Well, here's my friend's. And he told me Warren's story. He had a way better one than I ever did. I forgot what magazine it was, but he did the same thing as me. He ordered a couple of back issues of either Vampirella or Famous Monsters of Creepy. I don't know. So he orders it, and then, one day in the mail, it wasn't Vampirella. It was another one of the magazines. So one day in the mail, he gets a manila envelope. When he opens it up, it's the latest issue of Vampirella. And it says something like, this is issue one of your 2-year subscription. Apparently, they goofed up, and they sent him a 2-year subscription to Vampirella for, the price of, one or two back issues. So he was getting it for a couple of years, and he was like, hey, this is a great deal.
Wow.
So it gets even better. So So he's got friends in the neighborhood, and they trade comics or whatever. And he's got this, like, you know, 12-issue run of Vampirella and whatever. One of the kids was, like, really hot and bothered for it, wanted it real bad. So he goes, hey, I'll make you a deal. I got Amazing Fantasy 15 here. I'll trade you the Amazing Fantasy 15 for your Vampirellas, because the kid's dad, parents wouldn't let him buy it.
Yeah, yeah.
So dude was like, ka-ching, you know,
right.
Score. So basically he got Amazing Fantasy 15 for 12 issues of Vampirella. Now the bad part of the story is, like, a few years later, he needed some money. So he actually sold Amazing Fantasy 15 to Howard Rogowski, another one of the guys who had ads in the comic books. Remember Robert Bell and Howard Rogowski? They used to have ads in the comic books, sell your comics.
Oh, I remember the ads, yeah.
Yeah. He sold it for $50. I'm like, oh, $50.
Yeah, but what year was this?
70s.
Yeah, but, you know, the comic.
That book was worth a lot of money back then.
It
was worth more than $50.
$50 is a lot of money to get if you needed it back then.
Yeah, $50 in the early 70s, yeah, it was a lot of money, but that book's not worth, what, like $50,000 now?
You know, as a kid, even if you knew Amazing Fantasy was worth some money, it's just the fact that you've got 12 issues of Vampirella for one little skinny, you know, Marvel comic.
Done.
I know that, but I'm just saying, when you're young, it's
yeah,
kind of
when
hard
you're,
to equate, you know.
When you're young and you don't, I guess my friend Pat knew the intricacies of the business world a little better than the other kid did. And the other kid, and the Vampirellas were like forbidden fruit, you know. So it was like, yeah, okay, I'll give you the Spidey book. I know it's an old book, but I maybe the kid didn't even know it was the first Spider-Man. I'll give it to you, and I'll get 12 issues of this, like, semi skin mag that Warren puts out.
Like I said, every time somebody's got comic books, they keep coming to me and says, oh, well, I got these. Is this where? I don't know. You know, and I guess they think I can tell them the dollar value right away. And
yeah, I know who you're talking about.
I don't know, nor do I care. If I can't read them, then I don't.
Here's the deal. If it's got a 12-cent price tag or a 15, it's probably worth something, depending on what condition you have. That's like, take that. That's like the bottom line. It's probably worth a few bucks. Look it up on eBay. Yeah, you'll find somebody selling it.
But I think people think that either they're going to be able to retire off of it, or they think, I'm just going to beg them for it because I want it so bad because I love comics. And
well, that one dude that found the Action Comics in his walls, he could retire off. He sold it for $200,000.
Could have sold it for more
if they hadn't ripped over it, hadn't ripped it up or whatever. Speaking of comics, so what'd you read? What do you got to talk about?
Well, I'll be honest with you. This one was a strange one. We went on vacation. I stopped up to pick my daughter up in Tallahassee. And she pulled out what looked like romance books.
Yeah, I was wondering what that was.
And she had three of them. One of the grad students at her college, another visual arts major, he finished his grad work and he was leaving. And he gave her three of these. It's Emma Frost, which is the White Queen and the X-Men. When John Byrne and Chris Claremont were doing the X-Men, that's when the whole Dark Phoenix thing started. It was because of one of them was Emma Frost, which was the White Queen, and it was some of my favorite comics. Since then, she's been a major player in the X-Men stuff that I've never read. But these are small manga-sized books. They're all in color. And like I said, they look like teen romance book covers. And she's here. He gave them to me, so I looked at them. I started reading them. They're actually really good. It's done in a kind of a slight manga style, but it's a Marvel Comics. You know, the artwork's good. It's not the artwork that I go for, but it's well done. And it's basically talking about Emma Frost growing up in Massachusetts. Her father's a rich man, and she's got two sisters and a brother, and they all live under his thumb. And it's basically telling her story and how she starts getting these psychic powers, you know, and how it starts developing. But it's actually it's a really good story. It doesn't seem read like a superhero story. It basically reads like any young person struggling in day-to-day life, figuring out their place in the world. She just happens to be able to read minds.
Well, that's the impression I got from looking at it. It almost looked like it might be a romance book or something.
Yeah, some. There hasn't been too much romance in it, but a lot of angst.
Okay.
But I was surprised. I'm really enjoying them. That's one thing. You know, when you just, you know, read comics you like, you know, buy comics you like, and never let anybody else, you know, touch them, it doesn't really cross-pollinate the whole comics world or the world in general. I love to, you know, loan my comics and force other people to read stuff I like. And I like to read what other people have sometimes. And they may not always be a. We always talk about Chew. You know, Dad's got interested in Chew. My daughter bought the first trade, gave it to me because she didn't want it. I read it. I thought the thing was an incredible idea. I really enjoyed it. But I didn't want to buy it. And when she said, "Here, you can take it," well, I would have read hers. I would have bought them for her. And Dallas was interested, so I gave it to him. He read it. And same thing, he liked it, but it wasn't anything he wanted to buy. So Dez was interested. So, you know, Dallas lent it to him. I'm hoping Dez will like it, and Dez will get them so I can read them. So, and I guess that's the same with these. They're actually, it's a pretty good book. I've enjoyed them. I'd recommend them. It's a completely different depth for something I read way back in the 70s that I guess has been written to death since. But
is she like the White Queen or something?
Yeah, she became the White Queen.
That's what I thought.
So you did read those books.
I read the X-Men books, yeah. I remember her as the White Queen. Those are the Paul Smith issues or something?
No, the John Byrne issues.
Was it John Byrne or Dad? Yeah, I remember her.
Yeah, the Hellfire Club.
I want to ask you a question, because I picked up a couple books yesterday at the at Wilson's, and it was like issue 5 and 7, and they're interesting books, but they don't give you a clue about what are the atomics? What is their origin? Because you probably know this better than I do. It was kind of weird. I figured I'd just pick up two of them and maybe I'll get an idea of what it is. But I have no idea.
Oh, okay, yeah, that was the book I really
I know Madman's in there.
Yeah, what the deal was, there's a cartoonist named Mike Allred. I guess he did a lot of mini-comics the time. And Madman popped up in the 90s. And Tundra published the first three. They were square-bound black and white issues. He looked kind of like a superhero zombie type. He wasn't a zombie, but he just had that look. And the comics are really offbeat and fun. But the whole thing starts out with these beatniks pestering him. You know, there's this guy walking around in a white costume with a lightning bolt on the chest, a mask, a head mask. And these hipster beatniks are hassling him. And I guess he says, "Leave me alone," and he punches one, grabs another one, and he tears an eye out of the socket of one of them. And he goes on. And but it was a fun book. All these wild things happened in it. And I guess when Tundra published it, he said what happened was his son was going to school, preschool, and he wanted something for show and tell. So he was taking one of his dad's comics. But it was always, you know, these kind of horror type stuff. And he says, I don't think he should be bringing this. So they got him something else, but he decided he needed to do some comics his kids could read and share. So he created Madman. This is, of course, what did I do? I had him gouge somebody's eyeball out in the
first issue.
But Madman really changed. It turned this bright thing. But the Madman, his name was Frank Einstein. And I guess he was somebody that died in a car accident.
Frank Einstein,
And this Dr. Flim basically put him back together and brought him back to life. And the reason he wore the mask is his face was kind of ashen gray and all stitched together. Anyway, but he always had this bright, you know, optimistic way to him. And he wore the costume. He, I guess, worked for Dr. Flim. And there was another doctor. I can't remember.
Well, Dr. Flim's in the Atomics.
Yeah, he's in the other doctor. He kept taking his brain and injecting this serum to enlarge his brain. And his brain kept getting bigger and bigger, and he started wearing this giant wig to cover it up. And then they kept saying, "Stop doing this." And the doctor kept saying, "But the knowledge." And I think that doctor disappeared. But anyway, it was a fun book. But these beatniks somehow ended up becoming some type of atomic zombies. I guess chemicals got on them from the very beginning. So you have these these horrified mutant beatniks always after Madman, and everywhere he went they'd be, you know, riding him, and you always hated these things. And there's the male and female zombies or beatnik mutants. Finally, at one point, Madman walks up to him and says, "Why are you guys always on my case? What did I do to you?" And they couldn't quite answer. Then they started blaming him for what happened. He said, "Well, you guys did that." And they worked it out. And he basically said, "I think you're trying to go through a metamorphosis and you won't let yourself because you won't think past it." So he talks to them, works with them, and all of a sudden they just all blossom into these good-looking people. And they all had superpowers. One could stretch, you know, one could fly.
Oh.
And so they became the Atomics. And then Mike Allred had his AAA Pop imprint, and that was the book. Instead of, it was, I always looked at the Atomics as kind of like a Fantastic Four / Avengers comics, but
yeah.
At the top it said, Fantastic Four always said the world's greatest comic magazine. This one said the world's snappiest comic magazine.
Right.
And Mad Men always seemed like the Spider-Man character. He would appear in it, and then he wouldn't. You know, he'd show up at times. But I absolutely love that. It reminded me of the 60s. I love the colors. I love the whole idea of it. With the exception of Red Rocket 7, it's my favorite Mike Allred work. And they did, characters started coming out of the woodworks. One came from outer space. Another one joined the team. And it was always wild. It was always fun. And there was a couple, the girl.
It Girl.
Yeah, she was the popular. I think they're doing a comic.
Yeah, she's got her own book now.
But sure. But one of the characters, I can't remember her name, but she looked like a slug, like a undeveloped human slug, and she couldn't control it. It always reminded me of Ben Grimm's The Thing. Like, he couldn't change back, but she was always going, couldn't hardly even talk. And
who was the guy with the Iron Man mask on that had the horrible disfigured face underneath it?
I couldn't tell. I read it. I remember that. See, I got him confused because he was doing that, and I was really enjoying it, and then he stopped. And then he went to Marvel and was doing X-Force, which became X-Static later, Mike Allred.
Oh, did he? Okay.
With Peter Milligan. And some of those characters he created in that one reminded me of the
Atomics.
Atomics. And so I'd always get them confused on which one was which. I just found out. I thought there was like 8 or 9 issues of the Atomics. Kind of found out there's like 15 or 16. I've been buying them off offline. I've got one more issue to go, but I still enjoy that strip.
There's no trade paperback of it?
I think there might be.
Oh, okay.
I think there might be.
Well, the one thing that struck me the most is how little his artwork has changed. Because that book, I didn't realize it was from 2000. It's like 12 years ago, 13 years ago. And you look at the stuff he's doing now, it pretty much looks the same, which is great. I mean, he's got his style, and it was set from the beginning, and then here you go.
Well, he played around, because I know he brought Madman back. Dark Horse printed it in 2006, I think it was. I bought the first issue all excited, and I decided I didn't want to get it anymore, because it looked like the style had changed. It was good, but it was all done in pencil and colored on top of it. And I mean, it was strong work, but it just wasn't. I liked the crisp ink lines he had.
Mm-hmm.
And but somebody told me that if you looked at it now, he went back to what he was doing. I think what he was trying to show was a change. In each issue, it kind of reverted back to what he was doing. So he's got the chops. He's got the ability. But, yeah, Atomics is one of my favorites.
Well, in the Fantastic Four, it looks like the Atomics in a way.
Yeah, it has that feel.
I didn't realize he had changed. Even Red Rocket looks similar, even though it might be a little, the line work might be a little thicker on Red Rocket 7. But this was a fun book. It reminds me of an old 60s books, except like strange as all get out, with like the one character, the skunk, and
that came later.
And all these weird, like, kind of semi, there's a guy that like flies that looks like the Angel.
Yeah.
It really is reminiscent of the old Marvel books.
Oh, yeah, it has, but it's its own thing. And
it's
like
its own
said,
universe, yeah.
And with Mike Allred, there's always a great optimism to it, which I really appreciate because everything is grim and gritty most of the time, people want. But people seem to love Mike Allred. And like I said, he always has that childlike optimism all the time.
Well, this is the kind of stuff that I was always telling people. It's like I'm kind of getting tired of you know, people messing around with your Fantastic Four heroes or the Spider-Man or any other characters. Why don't they just create new superheroes and then make them weird? Well, he's doing exactly what I'm thinking. Yeah. I guess it never really caught on, but maybe one day it will. But that's exactly what should be done. Just create new characters, superheroes, maybe reminiscent of older ones, and have them, make them as quirky and as weird and as strange as you want to make them. Just don't mess with, yeah, you know, the classic guys.
Well, but people like that. You know, I mean,
well, you say that, but you realize that the comic book readership has dropped by like a zillions of people. So they're catering to a really low, like maybe like, I don't know what readership they have, but less than, I don't know, I would think that like maybe less than a couple million people read comic books, if that.
Right.
And back then they used to sell like, I don't know how many. It was a major form of entertainment. So obviously, you know, you may say, well, that people want that, but a lot of people don't.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. But I guess the issue is, if they weren't changing the characters over, you know, the mainstream
create new ones.
But if they weren't changing them, we'd be sitting there saying, you know, this is the same stuff they were doing back in the 60s. Why can't they move on, you know?
Kill them. You know, like in the Japanese book, you had your run and now you're gone. Maybe you can bring back an imaginary story or, you know, revive them or something like that. But just to take, Hollywood does this more than the comic books, though, but just to take the book and get a new writer and his spin, I can understand a writer putting a new spin on things, but at least keep the integrity of the character around, not just change them completely into somebody different, which is why Marvel does that Ultimates universe, so they could completely change the character and say, well, this is like an imaginary world as opposed to the regular imaginary world.
Well, that's how I've always felt. Everything you said right there is how I feel. And saying that, I still buy them. I've been buying those Daredevil books. You know, I like the creators.
They haven't messed with him that much.
Yeah, they haven't, but, I mean, I've enjoyed them.
And, I have, too.
Also, that FF book, which is based off the Fantastic Four, I've been buying that. It's been fun.
Well, the other one they got, too, which is more mainstream, I think the Mark Bagley, Mark Farmer book. There's two Fantastic Fours. There's the all-red one and the other one. The other ones, I guess, is the more mainstream
book. But, I mean, like I said, once in a while, there will be something I pick up. I mean, those characters were archetypes, but I agree with you. I always look at it, it's just there should be a shelf life for it and then stop.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean,
but it's becoming a movie merchandise.
Well, yeah, and that's, they're always recycling these old characters all the time. I
don't know,
one time Alan Moore was asking the question if the mainstream publishers would work out some kind of deal, and he said, well, you'll never see that happening. He says, I have no interest in recycling their old characters again. And I thought, well, yeah.
Did it once.
Well, and he did it quite well.
Yeah, he did.
He did it with great enthusiasm and love, and you know, and that's fine. And then he decides he doesn't want to, that's fine too. But, you know, and he's gone on and created other stuff. You know, I do think I like it better when people create their own, but I still read some mainstream books if I like the creator on it, you know.
Yeah, no doubt about it. But the guy, Mark Waid, who does Daredevil, he's kind of taking it back to feeling like the original book.
In a way.
He's actually captured the spirit, which is what I think should be done, as opposed to just take it in a completely, totally different direction, and just in the sense of, like, you know, stirring the pot or being, you know, controversial or whatever. Just go back to the original idea and make it better. And probably Daredevil wasn't even their best-selling book anyway.
No, it wasn't. That's what made it amazing when Frank Miller took it over and turned into what it did, because it became, I think, the best-selling book.
Uh-huh.
And it was always something on the verge of cancellation all the time.
But I got to tell you, as much as I like the Frank Millers, I still think I like the Gene Colan issues better than I like the Miller ones, just because they're more in a style of the classic superhero that I like. Miller took it in a different direction, but he did it right.
Yeah.
He didn't just do it for the sake of just change. He did it. He had an idea. He had a vision, and he took it and made it work.
Yeah, I had some of the Gene Colan issues. I look back on those with great fondness, but I didn't always get them. The Frank Miller work I always got. This new stuff with Chris Somney and, well, you said it, the guy's name is Mark
Waid, the writer, yeah.
It reminds me more of the 60s Daredevil.
It
has
does.
Elements of the Frank Miller Daredevil.
Oh, the Mazzucchelli Daredevil.
Yeah, but it's got it's its own book, but they have a lot more supervillains, some other
yeah, that's cool too.
It's fun, and I, you know, it's a good book that I enjoy.
Yeah, because Daredevil, I don't think has ever been one of their better selling titles. He's just a classic, one of their classic guys, and that kind of gets.
Well, you know, that happens a lot of characters. I was like Doctor Strange. My favorite was.
There's no Doctor Strange book now, is there?
I don't know. I haven't seen one, but
I don't think so.
I love those old Steve Ditko Doctor Strange. I just think those are some of my favorite Marvel comics besides the Thor and the Fantastic Four. I just loved what he did. But in the 70s, or excuse me, the 80s, I think is when Carl Potts took over as editor. They had all these great series. I remember Michael Golden did an issue. Paul Smith did some issues.
Yep.
And then they just started changing to one-shots. And they had Carl Potts drew an issue one time. What's that guy's name? I can't think of it all of a sudden. But he was... He did one issue where this woman showed up. She kind of had this power of seduction, sort of. Kind of find out it wasn't a superpower, just a woman that could, you know, get men to do what she wanted because she was really good looking and had this allure. But it was funny. It was kind of surreal. Kind of find out her father was an artist, and he went crazy, and whatever he drew became real. He had all these old style goblins and creatures. And Doctor Strange went over there and took care of it. Come to find out, he was possessed by some demon. And when he excised the demon, he said, how was it? He told the daughter, says, well, he'll still be an artist, but he won't have the level of genius that he had when he was possessed. I loved it. I wish I could remember who that artist's name
was. What issue was it? Do you remember?
No, I was in the Navy at the time.
It's in that Carl Potts one. You know, Carl Potts drew an issue himself.
Yeah, he did one of them. It was like a martial arts. The guy could do sound. It was a voice, but it was a martial arts done with that. I think it was based off of a real martial art.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, that's one thing we're talking about editors. That's an example there, Carl Potts. Carl Potts is a good artist. But I remember when he edited Doctor Strange, it took it to a new level. And people still talk about that period in the early and mid-80s. I love getting that. And every month, it was always something different. And it was usually, I like titles if it has a regular creative team that I like. But this one, you didn't always know who was going to be on it. It was just from one month.
Steve Colan did a couple, too, I think.
Yeah, it's different artists would show up and do one. And you know, I think even different writers. But
didn't Roger Stern write some of them?
I'm sure he did. Steve Laiolola drew some. Mm-hmm. That's when they killed Dracula. There was three issues where, Blade came on and they finally killed Dracula. I just thought it was one of the greatest comics I ever read, and I always look back on that series with great fondness. And then they brought in, what was that artist, Chris Warner, and they started doing more of that.
Oh, I remember him.
That otherworldly, you know, kingdom stuff.
I remember him, yeah. I forgot about that guy.
And it was after that when, I guess, Dick Giordano convinced Chris Warner to go over to DC to do Batman, and that's when Doctor Strange kind of stopped for me.
God, I don't even know if he's still being published. We'll have to check it out. I doubt it. I never see a Doctor Strange book anymore.
Well,
he might be guest starring in books.
Well, I know Brother Voodoo, I guess, supposedly took his place at one point. And I think Doctor
Talk about a 70s character.
he should have done a comic with Count Dante.
Yeah, that would have been perfect. Drawn by Gene Colan and inked by Frank Giacoya, I think, was the guy who inked those. Or Dick Giordano inked some of those, I think.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Well, Brother Voodoo meets Blackula. Oh, my God. I swear to God, if it wasn't selling at like 100 and change, I would buy it. I saw online, up and coming next year, there's a Blackula action figure coming out. It's like 100 and change. It looks just like Blackula. I would kill for that. I mean, if I can save up enough money, I might have to get that, because that is amazing. They're actually making a Blackula action figure.
You know, there's a guy, I can't think of that, Aphrodisiac. There's a comic called Aphrodisiac.
I've heard of it, yeah.
And he does all these old 70s Marvel-looking covers. It's a
I've heard of that, yeah.
But there's one where there's Medusa. You know, if you saw Medusa the Gorgon, you turn to stone.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The cover, she's upset that she's looking. He's looking straight at her, and he doesn't turn to stone. And his caption is, "Don't worry, baby. I'm already rock hard." Talk about, you know, blaxploitation.
Oh, my God.
It was awesome and over the top.
Blaxploitation was so great. But that's for a different show. The other thing that I got, which I will just talk about briefly, I guess, because we're getting towards the end here, was those three Archie books. Oh, my God. You know, I posted in my blog a couple of stories by Harry Lucy, who did a lot of the Archie books. He was the best, man. I think I like him better than Dan DiCarlo now. He got something out of those characters that I don't think anybody else could out of those things. These characters act in these comic books. The only guy I can think of that did something I think similar was Jack Kirby, how he could make you feel the characters' emotions and movements and the power or whatever. He was amazing, and Lucy started out as a mainstream, just kind of like a straightforward either romance or detective artist. But when he got to like doing the Archies, I don't know. Dan DiCarlo drew prettier, I think, and he was great in his ability to tell a story and all that. But this guy, I mean, those three books, it was like the one called The World of Archie. There was Pals and Gals, just a regular Archie issue, and two of them were towards the end of his life because. The Archie and I think the World of Archie was from like 75 or 76, but that guy amazes me how great he was.
Oh, I loved him. I'm always happy that I know who he is now.
We didn't even know.
Yeah, we just knew the style, but yeah, yesterday at Wilson's, I picked out four Archie books. One was a Sam Swartz Jughead.
He's great.
I got the other Dan DiCarlos, and I almost bought Harry Lucy, but he just did the front story, and there's two other people that did the back stories. And I ended up putting all those back because I found something else, or Dallas found something else that I wanted.
Yeah, right. It's like, hey, Don, get this. It's
no,
like, oh,
no,
okay.
He was thinking of getting it, and I jumped on it, and he said he wasn't getting it, so I had to put all my stuff back.
Yeah, Wilson's, the place we went to, has two full comic boxes of Archie's. Yeah. A lot of them have been picked through. These are like the most of them we see there from like the late 70s, early 80s, right? And you know, DiCarlo wasn't doing much work then, was he? I don't think.
Oh, no, because all the books I had, the two of them, it was all Dan DiCarlo all the way through.
Oh, okay. And I wasn't sure when he left or when, you know, what he
Well, he always did Betty and Veronica. It was funny because one of the books I was getting was Betty and Me, which normally he didn't do.
Okay.
And but on that one, he did all the stories. Archie comics were always like seven, eight-page stories, and you always got three or four in each issue. But sometimes Betty and Veronica was Dan DiCarlo, usually all the way through. But if you get other ones, it'd have a front story of Dan DiCarlo, and then other artists, and possibly newer, untried artists, in it just getting started. And I know Pep was one of those books. Betty and Me was one of those books.
Archie's Pals and Gals.
Yeah, those are the ones that usually, but Jughead was most of the time Sam Swartz all the way through.
Yeah, Archie was usually done by Harry Lucy. Betty and Veronica was usually done by
Dan DiCarlo.
Dan DiCarlo and Jughead was usually done by Sam Schwartz. Those are the three main guys.
And
then Little Archie was Bob Bowling.
And later on, I can't think of any of these artists' names. There's another one, Bob Bowling and Dexter Taylor.
Okay.
He came later. Yeah, those were great. I really like those IDW collections they were doing. I haven't seen any in a while.
Yeah, I'm sure they're putting them out, but those are great, the Harry Lucy one and the DiCarlo one, because they go back to the classic. I guess they're starting in the late 50s, early 60s, when their styles were more, you know, started to get stronger or whatever. But it's like, every time I find those books, I just sit down and read them, and it's kind of, they make me happy, you know? There's no, like, angst or anything. Oh, this is going to be like, you know, what's going to happen here or whatever. It's just like comedy, and it's just so drawn so well. I can't emphasize how great this guy was. He's become like one of my top 10 guys right now as far as like looking at a comic book and just seeing how simple you can make it, but how effective it can be. It's almost like, it's almost Toth-like in the sense that.
Yeah, and he was always very fluid. The characters,
very fluid,
they were very fluid
and
relaxed, and I absolutely
And it's got one of those strange Archie caveman stories that they usually do.
Which were my favorites, Archie 1. Yeah.
Is that what it was called, Archie 1?
Yeah.
Yeah, it had some goofy with and one of them had, for a time there, when Reggie's hairstyle changed and it became like wavy hair or whatever. Yeah. I guess the basic concept was back in the old days he was greasing it back so it was like slick, but then in the 70s he stopped putting all the dippity doo or whatever the hell you put on and it let it get too wavy and oh god, those are great books. So
that's the fun thing when you go to Wilson's is there's been a bunch of books. Jack Staff was one.
You found those there?
Yeah, I found a couple of issues and said, hey, this guy's pretty good. And then I started going back and, you know, buying all the trades and subscribing to the book. Also, I can't remember the name of it, that black and white comic. I was with you when I found two issues of it.
Hmm.
And I went over it on the show one time, but I ended up finding there was a 12-issue series. I can't think of that man's name. Andy Watson did it.
Oh, that romance-y thing.
Yeah, the romance-y with the superheroes.
I can't remember what it was called, but you showed it to me.
But it's one of my favorite series, and I never would have found it. I never would have known anything about it until we went to Wilson's. I grabbed those two issues. It's a series I love and I really enjoy, and unfortunately, one of you guys is going to be reading it, and we start recommending books again.
Okay, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I'll read it, or Dallas will read it.
Possibly both of you. But not the next one, because I already have everything laid out, what you guys are going to read.
Oh, God, all planned and ready to go. Well, I guess we better get going now. We're already past the hour mark, so.
There you go. Well, you usually finish something out with something I've never heard before, so.
So you want to end up with some music or whatever?
Well, that's what you've been doing.
All right, well, what about some Husker Du? Remember them?
Oh, I know the name. I don't know them. Before we go on, let's say a couple of things. If you listen to the show, please leave us an iTunes review if you are on iTunes. We haven't gotten any more. They really do help. If you're listening to us on some other area that you can find the show, you can go to our blog. All the stuff we talk about, we have examples. We also have links if you want to read further about the information we talk about. You can find us on bunchofdorks.com, which is where all these shows. Al's got another show called Destination Nightmare.
And then there's links to Slow Robot and Two Dimension right on my blog, so you can get on there from... It'll be like a hub. You go to my blog, and then you can just go directly to the other two right on the right-hand side there.
And that's the same with the Two Dimension.
Yeah, Two Dimension. You can find me on there, too.
But anyway, if you want to find our show, you just go to bunchofdorks.com and
click on the Cyclops. You had to write it down. Thank you for doing that, by the way. I appreciate that.
So anyway, that's all we got. I guess I'll be playing some Husker Du. And until then,
read more comics.
Say you got the tiger by the tail.